Blog Talk Radio.
You know that the ice cream scoop can make a child smile, and that by slowing us down, the traffic light can keep us going. You know that the lawnmower makes life easier, that the blood bank makes life possible. But did you know all these ideas came from the minds of African Americans? Support the United Negro College Fund, because a mind is a terrible thing to waste. Visit uncf.org or call 1-800-332-UNCF. Brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.
A thin light far away. In the winter of 1919, when Ida Mae was trailing her father out to the field, George and Pershing were learning to crawl, and the first wave of migrants was stirring to life. An astronomer made a startling discovery. The astronomer named Edwin Hubble, working out of the University of Chicago, looked through one of the most powerful telescopes of his time. What he saw would eventually become the most significant astronomical find of the century and would come to parallel the awakening of an isolated people in his own country. It would confirm what for generations had been whispered of but dismissed as impossible. It occurred near the start of a long pilgrimage of Americans seeking to escape their own harsh known world. Hubble identified a star that was far, far away and was not the same sun that fed life on Earth. It was another sun. And it would prove for the first time in human history that there were galaxies other than our own, that the universe was much bigger than humans had ever imagined, that there were, in fact, other suns. Good morning and welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys. I want to thank you so much for listening on this beautiful Saturday morning, no matter where you are, if you're in Europe, in Africa, in Canada, in America, in Atlanta, like some of my guests are. Thank you so much for listening this morning. You can follow me on Twitter.com/Joy Keys. You can become a fan of the show on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I just read from Isabel Wilkerson's The Warmth of Other Suns, a beautiful, epic novel you need to pick up today. She is, she started off as the correspondent and bureau chief at the New York Times, and she is the first black woman to win a Pulitzer Prize in the history of American journalism, and was the first black American to win for individual reporting. Good morning, Isabel Wilkerson.
Good morning. Great to be here.
I'm also joined by a great author and playwright, Calvin Alexander Ramsey. He wrote a play called The Green Book, and he also wrote a children's story called Ruth and the Green Book. Good morning, Calvin.
Well, good morning, Joy and Elizabeth.
Thank you so much, both of you, for listening, joining the show this morning, and thank you to the listeners again for listening. You're going to learn a lot today about history. I was just telling Isabel before the show started, she has a huge book. It's about 600-some pages long, I think, or so. But you will be immersed in it. You will not want to put it down. The stories are true, so that's what makes it so engaging. You're like, what? This really happened? This is what people went through? Isabel, you interviewed more than 1,200 people?
I stopped counting after 1,200.
You stopped counting after 1,200. So tell the audience why you decided to go down this path and write this book.
I decided to write this book because, first of all, I am a child of the Great Migration, as would be the majority of African Americans in the North, the Midwest, and the West. My mother migrated from Rome, Georgia, to Washington, D.C., and my father migrated from Southern Virginia to Washington, D.C., where they met and married and had me. And had there not been a great migration, a good number of us would not even exist. But I decided to write about this because this is one of the great underreported stories of the 20th century. A lot of us who were children of this great migration or grandchildren of the great migration, even the people who were participants, often did not talk about the experiences, and we often take it for granted. But this was the largest migration within the borders of our own country. This was an outpouring of 6 million African Americans from the South to the North and West from 1915 to 1970. 6 million people basically defected from the Jim Crow South, and they reshaped America as we know it.
Well, as I said, it was engrossing. I mean, just I didn't want to put it down, and I was like, oh, wow, I can't finish all this book. I'm like, oh, what can I read? And, you know, but I just wanted to keep learning more about these different characters. Now, you focused on three people. Tell us a little bit about, first, there was Ida. Talk about Ida and how you connected with her.
Yes. What I did was I interviewed 1,200 people in order to come up with three main protagonists who would represent the three major streams of this great migration. So one stream was up the East Coast from Florida, Georgia, the Carolinas, up to Washington, New York, Philadelphia, Boston. And then there was a middle one from Mississippi and Alabama and Tennessee and Arkansas to Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland. And then there was a third one, which is the least known of the three, which is from Louisiana and Texas to California and the entire West Coast, really. And so I needed to find three people. And so the first one to leave in the book is a woman named Ida Mae Gladney, who left Mississippi for Chicago in 1937. She had been a sharecropper's wife, and she was terrible at picking cotton, just awful at it.
Yes.
But they left because,
yes.
Which I love, but I hadn't really thought one way or the other about how difficult it was to pick cotton, but it was quite difficult. And there's a passage in the book which puts the reader into the world of what it was like. I happened to see cotton grow for the first time in my life when I went back to do research for this book. But in any case, she left because she and her husband and their two young children left because a cousin of her husband's had been beaten to within an inch of his life over a theft that he did not commit.
Yeah.
And
let me just interrupt you here a little bit. We were talking about the cotton, and it's funny that you mentioned that because I had turned that down to read to the audience. I want to read that little section about Ida there. This is in the beginnings. Her book is broken up in different sections. But it says she said she would try, but there was no use pretending. She was not going to be of much help in the field. She had never been able to pick 100 pounds. Yes, you heard me say that correctly. She had never been able to pick 100 pounds. You were expected to pick 100 pounds. That was the magic number. It was the benchmark for payment when day pickers took to the field. 50 cents. Yes, 50 cents for 100 pounds of cotton in 1920s, the gold standard of cotton picking. It was like picking 100 pounds of feathers, 100 pounds of lint dust. It was one of the most back-breaking forms of stoop labor ever known, wrote the historian Donald Holly. So I'm glad that you brought up the cotton picking, Isabel. I wanted to bring Calvin into the call a little bit. Now Calvin, for the audience, they may not be aware of this green book, but Isabel also mentioned the green book or guidebooks in her story. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I wrote a play, and I also did a children's book. A good friend of mine, he and his wife, I met years ago in California, and they were just dating then. And I lost contact with them over 20-some years, and bumped into them here in Atlanta. And by accident, and they invited me to the house, and this time they had 9 children, and the oldest one was named Little Tony, and I became like an uncle to the children and to the family. And a few years later, Tony was a young man driving, and he was killed in a car wreck. I went to the funeral, and the grandfather came down from New York, and he was a retired mailman in his 80s. And we was all in the backyard, and he mentioned to me that he was trying to find a green book. He hadn't been down south before, and he thought he still needed one. And this was just 8 years ago. And when he mentioned that, it just really piqued my attention. And at that time, I was on Emory's board, an advisory board, Special Collections at the Woodruff Library. And I was surrounded by a lot of material. And so I went back there for a meeting, and I found a copy there of an original Green Book, as well as 2 copies at Atlanta University. And that led me on this search and research. And from there, I started putting together this idea of a play. But the play developed first, and then the children book came second. I did the play at Yale this past January, Jewish.
And you also had a reading, Julian Bond. Julian Bond did a reading with you?
Yeah, we did a reading in D.C. September 15th at the Lincoln Theater. And Julian played Mr. Green. He played Victor Green. So it was well turned out. And Julian pulled in all his civil rights alumni, and they came, Taylor Branch and Anna Faye Pollard III, people that were, names were quite common in the struggle. And so it was good seeing all people come out and support Julian, as well as buy a children's book. And from what I could tell, they enjoyed the play as well.
That's wonderful. Isabel, now, we just talked about Ida, and Calvin was talking about his path of creating the play and the book, The Green Book. Now, there's the other character, George, and he was also picking, but he wasn't picking cotton, he was picking oranges. Talk to the audience about George.
Yes, George Starling had been a college student who where his family could no longer afford to send him, or chose not to spend the money to have him go to college at Florida A&M any longer. There were no black schools that he could attend in the town where he was from in Central Florida, and the white schools did not permit black people to go to college, the general colleges there in the state of Florida, and so he had to return to the work in the part of Florida that he was from, which was citrus picking, picking oranges and grapefruits and tangerines. That, too, was very difficult work, and it turned out that it was very dangerous work because the people had to climb into 40-foot trees with these ladders that were spliced together. And not only so the work was dangerous and the pay was worse, and he set about trying to get a little bit more from the grove owners when they would have to go out and pick. They were only being paid 10 cents, 12 cents for a box of fruit that would go out on the open market for $4. So he set about trying to get a nickel more per box, let's say, for depending upon the kind of fruit. Well, doing that was a dangerous proposition in 1940s Florida. Unions were not accepted at that time at all, and particularly among African Americans, that would not have been accepted for African Americans to be doing that. And he ended up having to flee for his life to Harlem in 1945. That was his story. And then the third...
No, I was going to say, that was one of the points, too, that I think that people need to realize that so many people had to leave people that they cared about behind. And that creates a toll, not a psychological, emotional toll, I think, on people that, like you said, people didn't speak about the migration because I think there was a lot of joy, but there's a lot of pain. It's just a lot of mixed emotions, leaving, going to the quote-unquote new world. So he wasn't the only one that had to leave a wife behind.
Absolutely. He actually left behind all of the people that he knew, a small town. His wife, he had to leave because he had to set out on his own to get situated in New York, which is also what a second character, Robert Foster, did. He set out to basically scope out the new world before he could send for his family, which is very common. Mm-hmm. And in many respects, the idea of this great migration was not simply people picking up and leaving like you would for a new job or relocation. People were leaving everything that they knew. This was before the era of cell phones and Skype and GPS. I mean, when people left, they were leaving for good, not knowing what the future held, not knowing if they would ever even see their parents again. Sometimes if they left, the only way that they'd have any contact with their family would be a telegram would arrive saying that a parent had died. That is what they were leaving. The enormity of the emotional toll that this would have taken on people, I don't think has been really quite understood. And they had to keep a lot within them. They didn't often tell their children and grandchildren about what they'd gone through because in some of them there was a sense of shame of having picked cotton or having been in a caste system that kept them down. The Jim Crow was a caste system. It was a system in which, like any caste, keeps you fixed in your place. They had no options to do the kinds of things that we think of now. It was against the law in Birmingham for a black person and a white person to play checkers together. That's how extreme the world was for them. In many courtrooms in the South, there was a black Bible and a white Bible to swear to tell the truth on. The same King James Bible, but one was the one that black people could touch, and one was the one that white people could touch. That is the world that they were leaving. And then not to even mention the fact that every 4 days during the decades leading up to the migration and around the time of the beginning of the migration, a black person was lynched every 4 days. somewhere
I'm
in the
so
south.
I'm so glad you mentioned that. So, I'm so glad that was one of my notes I wanted to definitely bring out. And you know, sometimes people get a little uneasy when we start talking about the history of this country. Black people and white people get a little uneasy. Well, why are we bringing up, you know, well, we passed that. Well, you know, now you can go to school. Now you can get the job. But now you can do the. But I think what's important about your book, Isabel, is that you're talking about generations. So people talk years, but I think they need to talk generations, because generations affect, it kind of scrunches the time up a little bit. So now you can say, this is why this incident is still affecting a community of people, because the great-grandmother talks to the grandmother talks to the mother is talking to the child and passing down these stories. I want to read again from your book one of the major issues and why people were leaving, the sense of oppression, the air being so heavy, not being able to look up and have to step off the curb, like you said, using the Bible, can't go to the bathroom, you know, can't even wear a suit. Whoa, one story. I won't even talk about that yet. Let me just read this. This is from the beginning. That October, sorry, it's a wonderful book, everybody. Please pick up The Warmth of Other Suns. It's the epic story of America's great migration. I'll be giving away a free copy, and I'll tell you how to win a free copy of a book in just a minute. But I want to read this. That October, a 23-year-old colored farmhand named Claude Neal was accused of the rape and murder of a 20-year-old white woman named Lola Kennedy. Neal had grown up across the road from Lola Kennedy's family. He was arrested and signed a written confession that historians have since called into question. But at the time, passions ran so high that a band of more than 300 men, armed with guns, knives, torches, and dynamite, went searching for Neal in every jail within 75-mile radius of Marion. Now, I'm not going to read everything in the book. You got to pick it up, The Warmth of Other Suns. But let me just tell you, the gist of it is they had to move this black man from jail to jail to jail, from different cities, towns, in the dark of night, trying to hide him from this lynch mob. They finally moved him more than 1,500 miles away. They found him. The mob drove several hours to where he was in jail, took him out of the jail. No, they didn't just lynch him. They burned him. They chopped his fingers off. They castrated him. People took his body parts as souvenirs. And then, let me tell you, the father of the white young lady who supposedly was raped and murdered by him got mad at the crowd because he didn't give the first shot to this young man. I'm sorry, people, you can hear I'm upset in his voice, but this is what people were leaving. This is what people were trying to get away from. And this went on for more than several days, and then they reburned him. So this is what people were running from. Isabel, Claude, I mean, Calvin, do you have any comments about Claude's situation?
Wow. Well, you know, my mother, immigrated from Southern Virginia to Baltimore. My father came up from North Carolina, and he met in Baltimore and had me. So I'm familiar with.
So you wouldn't exist without the Great Migration either.
Pardon me?
Yeah. You wouldn't exist without the Great Migration either.
Exactly,
just like most of us.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and so my uncles, and they all, you know, it's funny about the track of people from, you know, northern North Carolina and southern Virginia. A lot of them either went to D.C. or Baltimore. A lot of my father's people went to Baltimore because of the steel industry and things like that. Mm-hmm. But they were, also leaving, you know, all types of, oppression and limitations on their growth and what they could do as an individual, and coming off of tobacco farms, as whether they owned the land or whether they were doing, sharecropping. And I spent a lot of time in the summers going back there, you know, staying with grandparents, things like that. And so, I understand the oppression. I remember the first time I went back there, and I was in a health center, and there were a bunch of kids. I think I was in the fourth grade, and there was a colored water fountain and white water fountain, and I wasn't paying attention. And so I just went and got some water because I really wasn't feeling it in Baltimore, you know, and so I just wasn't thinking. And then I looked at my other playmates, look on their face when they saw me drinking out of the fountain, the white fountain. I mean, the fear that they had on their faces, I just never will forget it. And that fear was really put into them by their parents so that they wouldn't do things like this or wouldn't get in no
mm-hmm.
trouble. But it was
right,
just, you know, just ingrained in them, you know, and I never forgot that. And I just looked at them, and they were just really, you know, just, and these were kids. These were little children in fourth grade. So it was,
That's one of the things Isabel talks about in her book. She talks about parents having to train their children to deal with this oppression, walking that thin line. And Isabel, one of the last characters we want to mention him is the doctor. And I think that's important to mention because everybody had different paths. There were doctors and lawyers and things, but they, too, were oppressed. Isabel, talk to us about the third character.
Yes, Dr. Robert Joseph Pershing Foster grew up in Monroe, Louisiana. He became a surgeon, a very good surgeon who served as a captain in the Army during the Korean War. But when he got out of the Army, it turned out he could not practice surgery in his own hometown of Monroe, Louisiana. And so then he decided to set out on a course for California. He drove the entire way alone because he was going to set out and get himself established and then send for his family. But he found that the drive was much more treacherous than he had anticipated. He had not realized that Jim Crow, that the caste system that he had grown up under, that segregation extended much farther than he thought, which means that this is not just a Southern story, it's an American story. It's not just a black story, it's an American story because it involves people other than, it involves everyone who was alive at that time somehow had a role in this caste system.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened was when he got to a certain point, well past Texas, which was the end of Jim Crow officially, he found that he could not find a room to no one would give him a motel room to rest.
Right.
So that meant
right.
he had to drive many, many of those western states, hundreds and hundreds of miles at night through the desert, through the curving U-turns of the mountains to get to California without sleep at night. And
yes,
this is where the green books come in.
The green books.
That's
you mentioned
the green
about the Bibles, and that's what helped them.
Well, it would help people generally in the South. But if there was no reference in the green book to the place where you happen to be, you were out of luck, which is what he was. So we ended up having to – so I do mention the green books extensively, and I must say I was very proud to have gotten one on eBay before they became popular as a result of the play.
You heard that?
I was really happy.
They became popular because of your play.
Yeah.
Yeah,
they
become so popular they're hard to get now. But but anyway, he could not benefit from the green book because he was beyond the reach of where the green book would have been, where people would have been describing it in New Mexico and Arizona.
Yeah, yeah.
That part, it was sparsely populated anyway. So he was forced to drive all that distance without sleep. And I attempted to recreate it. I had my parents in the car with me driving all the way. We came on hairpin turns. It was night. It was desert. It was many hundred miles sometimes between settlements. Even now, it's sparsely populated. And I began to veer from the road, and my parents said, we've got to stop. You've got to stop the car. And if you won't stop the car, let us out.
Right.
If you won't stop the car, then let us out.
Yeah,
it took an
emotional
toll.
It's like you're running, but it's like you don't know where you're going to end because you don't know where you can stop. Because if you stop somewhere, you might get shot, you might get killed. Nobody's going to take notice. Nobody can bear witness to you at the time. If you're a black person, your voice is not going to be heard. But he was one of the very successful stories in terms of material wealth. And actually, he had a song that Ray Charles sang about him. I want to read a little bit of that real quick. We have about 6 minutes left, but I want to read this. This is a song that Ray Charles wrote about the doctor. Well, I called my Dr. Foster, and when the girl answered the phone, I got a funny feeling the way she said Dr. Foster had gone. She said he left with a lady patient about 24 hours ago. I added two and two, and here's what I got. I got, I'll never see that girl no more. I ain't seen hide nor hair of my baby since she went away. If Dr. Foster has got her, then I know I'm through, because he got medicine and money, too. I ain't seen hide nor hair of my baby since that day. That was by Ray Charles, a reference to the character in Isabel Wilkerson's book, The Warmth of Other Suns. If you're listening to the show this morning, please check out their website, isabelwilkerson.com, also calvinalexanderramsey.org. Those are two sites you can learn more about both of my guests this morning. But I'm giving away one of the books by Isabel Wilkerson, The Warmth of Other Suns. And if you want a free copy, you need to email me Barack Obama's date of birth. Email me at SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@hotmail.com, Barack Obama's date of birth, and I will be able to send you a free copy of The Warmth of Other Suns. But, Calvin, so this book has helped so many people.
Joy, please try to do The Children of Ruth and the Green Book. I'll make sure my publisher sends you a copy so you can let your listeners know that they also can get a free book. So no problem.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Thank you so much for your generosity. I want to mention to the listeners, you are having a book signing Saturday, November 13th, 1 to 4 p.m. at High Museum of Art, Atlanta Book Signing with Mr. Ramsey. Again, that's Saturday, November 13th, 1 to 4. Also, Isabel is going to have a book signing November 14th. Isabel, are you still doing that at 7 p.m. At the Hilton Americas? Isabel, you
I am not. I'm not familiar with that one, but I am scheduled to be at the Atlanta Press Club on December 6th. So that's
okay,
that's the plan.
Okay.
That's the book signing I'm doing.
Okay.
Where's going to be? Isabel is going to be where?
The Atlanta Press Club on December 6th. That would be
if you would
go on AtlantaPressClub.org. You should be able to get the details of that.
Yeah. I'm going to be in New York that week. I have a new play opening up in the East Village, but we got to somehow exchange some kind of numbers since we're both here in Atlanta.
You're absolutely right.
I want to give a thanks and a shout-out to Megan Cassidy, who helped connect Isabel and I. I also want to give a shout-out to a friend of mine, Zoe, who kind of pushed me again to contact Mr. Ramsey because I was hunting him down. I needed a green book to hunt him down. And we finally connected. I got him on the show, so I'm so happy. I want to thank both of you so much for coming on the show this morning. Both of you are doing some great work. Everyone, please check out IsabelWilkerson.com. You can find out more about the book, her research that she did, upcoming book signings. Also check out CalvinAlexanderRamsey.org. Please pick up a copy of The Warmth of Other Suns. Also pick up a copy of Ruth and the Green Book, but I'll be giving away, it sounds like, thank you to the generosity of Calvin, some copies of that. So stay tuned on the fan page and also on my Twitter account, twitter.com/JoyKeys, or look us up on Facebook Saturday mornings with Joy Keys. Calvin and Isabel, thank you so much for the wealth of information that you're sharing with the world. I wish you much success in all your future endeavors. Isabel, please come back again with your next book. And Calvin, please keep me in mind with your next play that you're doing in New York.
All right,
thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. You have a wonderful Saturday, okay?
Okay.
Same to you.
Thank you so much. Everybody, please check out The Warmth of Other Suns. Also check out Ruth and the Green Book. And I'll be giving away a free copy of The Warmth of Other Suns. Please email me the date of birth of Barack Obama. And you can email me at SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@hotmail.com. You can become a fan on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. And you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/JoyKeys. Have a wonderful Saturday.
You know that the ice cream scoop can make a child smile, and that by slowing us down, the traffic light can keep us going. You know that the lawnmower makes life easier, that the blood bank makes life possible. But did you know all these ideas came from the minds of African Americans? Support the United Negro College Fund, because a mind is a terrible thing to waste. Visit uncf.org or call 1-800-332-UNCF. Brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.